Good evening. Well done, Ellie. It's hard, isn't it?
It's still a little rocky there, but...
It sounds very nice.
It's a good practice.
It is. It's a wonderful practice. I hope everybody has a chance to do it. Yeah. Well, Sasheen was extremely smooth and quiet. Was really the most smooth and quiet Sasheen I think I've ever sat anywhere. It just, Donalyn did a very low-key, unstressed, kind of quiet way of arranging and keeping everything arranged. There was hardly any talking to speak of. Everybody seemed to know what they were doing, and they just did it. It was really very nicely done. Edith was there for a little while. Ron came for a little while. Samia was there. And Jane, of course, came from Canada and sends her very best to all of you. She was a live wire. She was just really right there. She was sewing herself. She's sewing an Okesa, and she was also helping everyone to sew their things. So during the work period, there was a little sewing bustling going on up in the community room. It was just all very, very nicely done. And already, I think people are thinking about August and trying to figure out how are we going to do it in August, and if we could do it this way or that way. So it's, though that seems like a long time away, it's not that far, actually. The Jikoji is turning out to be more and more comfortable. And they have a crew up there. I don't know what they're doing, but they're doing some huge more project up there to change things even better. So every time we go, it's a little more comfortable, a little less muddy, a little more civilized and comfortable to be there. Turkeys are still there. First thing in the morning, just before the sun comes up, you hear this gobble, gobble, gobble. It's amazing. And you come out sort of, you know, everything all sort of calm, and then there's these strange faces of these weird birds. They're just such an astonishing face they have, thing down and these things all around. So, this came up at a certain point in one of the talks, and somebody, when I told the story of the mistake I made trying to find the poetry reading, and the mistake I made blaming everybody else but myself, and I was chastised a little bit by someone who thought that I wasn't adhering to the teaching here, that I was having an opinion about how it should have been, and that one shouldn't have opinions, and that if you just drop whatever you're doing and not worry about it and just go on in the present, that you're a whole lot better off. And I was surprised by that, and I thought about it. I didn't really respond very much at the time, but then I thought about it later, and I thought, well, that's an opinion too. And actually, come to think of it, this whole thing is an opinion about having opinions. So it's really important to pay attention to what's really going on in here. Or it's easy to get lost in it and think that there's some kind of pure state to be in that's different from this stained and messy state of our ordinary life, and that somehow if we just drop our mind in some way, turn our mind off or become somebody else, that then we'll be happy or perfect or something. It's not really pointing to that. It's pointing to what we think of as ourself, and trying to help us to think past our attachment to the idea of ourself. We have an idea of who we are, and it's just an idea. It's just one more thought. Dan?
Is the very origin of ideas part of the problem? Like,
yes.
Sometimes we think that, you know, the person who kind of chastised you a little bit, they thought, probably, you know, from their point of view, correctly, mm-hmm. they were bringing forth something that wasn't from them. They thought it was from the teaching.
Mm-hmm.
So, as if that were some way getting around having their opinion, right?
Yeah.
But as you say, the origin of that idea, oh, I'll bring up the teaching and present it to Angie, that in and of itself, the origin of that is that person.
Yeah.
I mean, the teaching is evident to you certainly, and to us as practitioners, it's that's just there. And yet this person chose as an origin to bring this to you. But isn't that actually why, like you assert, it too is an opinion, because it came from them?
Yes.
It doesn't really matter what the opinion was.
No, really not. So it's tricky.
Yeah.
It's tricky to... And yet it's so important. It's really interesting and important material. I thought I would talk about 4, 5, and 6 tonight. I've numbered each of the lines. So 4 is, if you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. 5 is to set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. And 6 is when the deep meaning of things is not understood, the mind's essential peace is disturbed to no avail. So this last one is really the essence of it. That's what he's trying to get to, that there is a deep meaning beyond all these thoughts that are carrying on in our mind continually, and that unless we allow ourselves to discover that stillness that Sun Tsang talks about so much, that the practice of samadhi gives us a deeper understanding of our life and the activity of our mind. It isn't that we cut off our mind. It isn't that ideas are even bad. It's just that we don't understand what they are, or the origin, as you say. So, Sun Tsang talks about the internal self-talk that we have. I like that. We have what did she say in the novel? Mr. and Mrs. Yakety Yak with their little children, blah, blah, blah. That's what's going on in our mind all the time. Just constant commentary and a lot of judgment, usually. That's why monks are often forbidden to walk in shopping centers and where the shops are, because it's so attractive to keep looking in the shop and saying, oh, I want one of those, and that's no good, and oh, look at that. and your mind just becomes all stirred up. And that kind of stirred upness is about greed and anger, basically. And once we're all stirred up, we don't really know who we are anymore. We're just caught up in a swirl of stuff. So that is a kind of very unpleasant confusion, and we can live a whole life that way without even knowing there's some other way to be. But once we begin to sit and settle down and find where it's quiet inside us, not out there somewhere, but in here, then that quiet begins to sustain us. And whatever else is going on isn't disturbing anymore. And as I discovered, you know, you get a lot of self-talk, but you don't have to believe it. Some of it is very important and helpful and interesting. We are constantly being supported by what lives us. But it's important to recognize what's wholesome and helpful and what isn't. So, a lot of our self-talk is about giving ourselves a kind of persona so that we know who we are. I remember when I first got married a long time ago, I had a silver wedding ring. And for the longest time, every time I was a little bit nervous, I would touch the ring and think, oh, I'm married. It's okay, I'm married. And it was totally false. I mean, it didn't make me any safer or better or anything, but I just thought, I'm a married woman. See, it must be all right. I think we do a lot of little things like that that we don't really recognize to shore up our sense of ourself. Make us feel a little, not even important, just maybe more comfortable, less anxious. Sung Song says about this, the internal chatter that we have prevents the mind from illuminating itself. I like that very much. Prevents the mind from illuminating itself. It's like standing in the way of the light. So he says the deep meaning of things on this line, when the deep meaning of things is not understood, the mind's essential peace is disturbed to no avail. Sung Song says the deep meaning of things is seen through the framework of shunyata, through the framework of meditation. The purpose of the shunyata dialectic is to break down the fixations we have with the nature of things as self-abiding. This is not a negation of the existence of things in a provisional sense. It's just that only our fixations with them that continue to disturb endlessly the stillness of the mind and do not allow us to enter into silence. Self-abiding. It's all coming and going. It's flowing through us continually. Our ideas, our thoughts, our judgments, our life is flowing through us. And we tend to want to freeze it in place. So many of our thoughts are disturbing thoughts, and our ideas keep us stirred up in this way, unnecessarily. There's a real freedom in, I thought the other day, there's really nothing at stake. We hold on to and try to fixate on our ideas because we feel like there's something at stake. And we better be on the alert and better fix ourselves in a certain position and hold everything still, because otherwise, and then what? Otherwise what? There really isn't any otherwise. The truth is, we just live moment by moment, really not knowing what's going to happen next, and having really very little control over what's going to happen. In a certain sense, of course, we make a plan, but anything can happen to that plan, and often does. Yes.
That touches my background so much, the idea of the plan, like having things laid out, right?
Yes.
Now, given what we were talking about, being opinionated and stuff, this is like the ultimate version. Not only do I now want to follow a plan, but I want you people on my project to follow my plan.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
How egocentric is that? But the thing that's funny about it is, not having a plan means having like no practical sense of what's in the future, which is clearly that's clearly not. I don't think that's what the practice is saying. I mean,
no.
There is a future out there. We don't know what it is, and not thinking about it at all is clearly not practical. But correct me if I'm wrong. The practice says, the plan is literally like one little stream of a sequence of events out into the future. And if you find yourself, even after only a step or two along that path, finding that reality is not handing you that sequence, if you get all bent out of shape and get mad and things aren't going my way, That's failure of practice. That's failure to see the dynamic, or that everything's changing. We're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
That's right.
So if you look at planning from the practice's point of view, it's okay to say, I'd like to go in that direction. But it would be kind of foolish to say, if I don't get these 10,000 things along the way between now and tomorrow only, that's missing the whole point of the flow of reality.
That's exactly it. Yes. So you can't stake everything on your plan. You of course we have to have plans. We have to know what we're going to do next. And it's very well, in fact, to, if we're serious about our practice, to develop a kind of intention that helps us get through every, as a kind of plan that gets us through every moment of our day. That if we set our intention toward truth, stillness, practice. It's hard to say what the word is, but we can all feel what our deep intention is in our life. And keep that intention, then whatever happens to our plans, we can move with it flexibly and easily. It's the lack of flexibility that we're really talking about. And we tend to get wedded to our ideas of how it should be. And when it's not the way it should be, Coben always used to say, there is no should be kind of thing. that's all just our own sort of anxiousness or something, that we want it to be just so. Wendy?
So the kind of control we can intend or seek would be just not to get frazzled by the changes that happen to us.
Yeah. Yeah. Because they are what we are. We're nothing different from what is actually happening to us. That's the truth of it.
Things that really touch our life, not just things that we take in.
Well, take in
the world.
It's all us.
It's a pretty big self.
It is. It is.
How can you live that way in the world?
Well, you're just one little blip in a great big world, but you are the world at the same time. So when you get caught up in your own blippiness, that sense of maybe too much self-importance, you can remember how big it is and how small and limited we are really. And how, in a sense, we are directing our lives, presumably, in some ways. But in another way, it's like Zazen. We're sitting, but we're being sat at the same time. We're living, but we're being lived. Much more than we think. So, that's why we keep bowing, you know, and just bowing around in the world is very helpful to remind us of exactly, you know, how, what our size is, you could say. That otherwise we begin to think it's me and them or me and it. And if we just bow and begin to completely respect the world around us, we begin to see it in a different way. I told you that story of Jack Kornfeld and the gardener. Do you remember that? Jack Kornfeld was practicing in Bodh Gaya in his young years, and he had a lot of big ideas about his practice and what he was going to, how enlightened he was going to be. And he had a teacher. There's some very nice monks there. And he, one of those monks was his teacher. And the monk noticed that Jack had an awful lot of judgments about people. And he suggested that he practice metta, loving kindness, with the gardener. The gardener was this ancient little scrawny guy who only wore a dhoti, just a diaper kind of thing. He was just all kind of naked and skinny and shaky, and he just was, you know, Jack thought, gardener? I'm supposed to send loving kindness to the gardener? And in his youthful foolishness, he thought it was a ridiculous idea, but the teacher said to do it, so he did. And he said after a couple of weeks, he just was completely in love with the gardener and knew him by then. They began to be friends, and every time he saw him, he would send some love his way. And it turned from this ugly kind of feeling in him and no relationship at all to something else. And it was all coming out of Jack. Only.
discussion barging into your talk, but that is making me think of something that I wanted to say, and about this idea that thoughts get in the way of our true mind, or our, what you said, I mean, that all this, the disease of the mind, mm-hmm. chatter and all of this. I think what's really been grabbing a hold of me from reading the book and reading the commentary is that that's, by all that chatter and all that feeling, we miss an opportunity, such an amazing opportunity to be present and to sort of know how to help the world, or to know how to be in the world in a much more profound way. And somehow that really got through to me, that it's not just, oh well, it would be a nice thing to do to learn how to minimize the chatter, but it's really, really important.
Yeah.
I somehow saw it in a different light because of this
mm-hmm.
study.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really helpful.
Yeah. Yeah, it is very helpful, extremely. And I think it's important to remember that he's calling this trust in mind. And the mind he's talking about is the underneath the chatter mind. And actually, ultimately, of course, I mean, you can torture yourself with the chattering mind and denigrate it, and say, oh well, it's just a bunch of garbage that's going on in my head. But actually, that's all coming from the same place. So it's not well to even put any part of ourself down or try to control it. Just understand it really, really well. And if you understand it, it doesn't trouble you as much. Anything else? Well, is a little strange, but I've been invited to give a poetry reading next Tuesday. So it was a kind of invitation that I did not feel free to turn down, since it's the same group and the same situation as before. I would feel very bad not to go. So I haven't done anything about next Tuesday. I wanted to ask you all what you wanted to do. Ritu said she wanted to go to the poetry reading, and Wendy went last time. Maybe you want to go too. We could all go to that. I expect not everybody would like that very much, but let me know what you think.